Good day, and welcome to the ACS Law Voting Rights Membership Call. Today's conference is being recorded. At this time, I'd like to turn the conference over to Jesse Grauman. Please go ahead.
Good afternoon, and thank you all for joining us for today's ACS Membership and CLE Call After Shelby County, the Future of the Voting Rights Act. My name is Jesse Grauman. I am a Director of Policy Development and Programming here at ACS. This call is being recorded and will be made available on the ACS website as well as on our podcast, ACS Law Talk, which is available via iTunes. Over the last several years, the laws governing voting and election administration have become increasingly prominent in both the legal and political landscapes. From standards for counting votes to voter ID requirements to the drawing of legislative districts, voting and election laws can be significant and even dispositive factors in the outcomes of elections from the local level all the way up to the presidency of the United States. This past summer, the Supreme Court issued a 5-4 decision in the case of Shelby County versus Holder that invalidated a key portion of the Voting Rights Act of 1965. Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act required certain states and jurisdictions with a history of discrimination in voting to submit any changes to their voting laws to either the Department of Justice or a 3-judge panel of the Federal District Court in Washington, D.C., a process known as preclearance. Although the Supreme Court did not invalidate Section 5 itself, it found that the coverage formula in Section 4 of the Act that determined which jurisdictions were subject to preclearance was unconstitutional. The practical result is that Section 5 has been, at least for now, effectively nullified. Today, we'll be discussing the impacts of Shelby County as well as the prospects for potential legislative responses. To lead us in that discussion, we're very pleased to have Julie Fernandez, a senior policy analyst at the Open Society Foundations. Julie has a wealth of experience both in government and in the civil rights community. In the Department of Justice, she has served as Deputy Assistant Attorney General for Civil Rights, as well as Counsel to Assistant Attorney General for Civil Rights, Bill Lan Lee. She's also served as a Special Assistant to President Clinton at the White House Domestic Policy Council. Outside of government, in addition to her current work at Open Society, Julie was a Senior Policy Analyst and Senior Counsel at the Leadership Conference on Civil and Human Rights, and has also worked at the National Legal Department of the ACLU. Finally, Julie previously clerked for the Honorable Diane Wood, the Chief Judge for the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals. Before turning this over to Julie, just a few logistical points. The call will last approximately 30 minutes. Julie will offer remarks for the first 10 to 15 minutes, and then we'll open the call up to questions. The operator will instruct you how to ask a question. We'll just ask that if you're a member of the media, please identify the outlet you represent. If you would prefer to send in questions via email at any time throughout the call, you can email me directly at jgrauman@acslaw.org. Finally, if you're interested in CLE credits and didn't sign up beforehand, you can email Katie O'Connor at kocoonnor@acslaw.org. And now I will turn it over to Julie Fernandez.
Thanks so much, Jesse. So as Jesse noted, I'm going to just spend a few minutes talking about the impact of the Supreme Court's decision in Shelby County versus Holder, and then some thoughts around a possible federal legislative response to the decision. So first, as Jesse said, the Supreme Court on June 25th, 2013, this year, invalidated the coverage formula that determines which places around the country are subject to the Section 5 preclearance regime. As many of you know, previously, Section 5 obligations attached to all or part of 16 states around the country focused on all of 9 states that are mostly in the Deep South. In its decision in Shelby County, the court was clear that what it was not doing was saying the preclearance system itself was unconstitutional. There's a question about whether or not some members of the court do think that the preclearance mechanism itself is unconstitutional, but the decision clearly didn't say that. The flaw, according to the court, was that Congress didn't look to current conditions when reauthorizing the formula in 2006. Now, it is true that when Congress reauthorized the coverage formula in 2006, it looked at a lot of recent voting rights problems as well as the history of discrimination that led to the need to have the Section 5 preclearance regime in the first place. So there was an extensive record at that time around current Voting Rights Act violations, comparing those kinds of violations in covered versus non-covered states. There was testimony around those who thought that the formula should be reauthorized as it is, and those that thought it should be modified. But nevertheless, the court was unpersuaded that enough of the sort of driver behind the reauthorizing of the coverage formula was key to what it described as current conditions. So what are we left? What is the impact of that? The biggest impact of the invalidation of the coverage formula is that no longer do many of these places around the country have to have all of their voting changes pre-approved by either the federal court or the Department of Justice, as Jesse outlined. What that means is that what we're left with in section in the Voting Rights Act is not nothing, but it is substantially weaker than what we had before. So we still have Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act, which is the part of the Act that is used to sort of bring affirmative challenges to policies or practices in the voting area that have either a discriminatory purpose or a discriminatory result. Section 2 cases that necessarily, by their nature, are after-the-fact cases or after-the-fact remedies. You have to be able to they're brought after the discriminatory practice is in place. They take a long time, and they're very expensive. I think there was a study fairly recently that cases under Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act are sort of the second or third most complicated civil litigation in our federal courts. We also have left something known as Section 3C of the Act. Section 3C is a provision where if you're in an existing constitutional lawsuit and the court makes a finding that the voting practice being challenged is unconstitutional, violates the 14th or the 15th Amendment, is intentionally discriminatory, the court can order as a remedy that that jurisdiction be subject to Section 5 preclearance. But you have to have a finding of intentional discrimination as a predicate, and the scope of what the court orders can be, it's sort of up to the court. Now, as I mentioned a minute ago, in Section 2 cases, the main vehicle to vindicate those constitutional rights, you don't have to show intentional discrimination to prevail. You could show discriminatory results. So courts don't often find intentional discrimination unless they need to. So this is a pretty significant bar to being able to get a 3C remedy. So the gap that I think is left here is that there are some places that because of both their history of discrimination and their sort of current day conditions that still present challenges with being able to have real equality for racial and language minority voters, that some places I think still need to have some form of preclearance. There also needs to be a way to stop discriminatory voting changes outside of those places that have preclearance to be able to stop discriminatory voting changes in those places from being implemented. Because whatever new coverage formula may be developed that would key to preclearance will necessarily be fairly narrow. And the last thing that I think we need that we are missing now is notice and disclosure. In the Section 5, in the robust Section 5 world, the world pre-June 25th, 2013, all of the places covered by Section 5 had to provide public notice of all their voting changes. They had to submit all of them to DOJ, and that process was fairly transparent and public. And also one of the requirements in their being able to obtain Section 5 preclearance was that they had engaged with the minority community about the voting change in question. So the whole obligation to make these changes public and to engage with the minority community is no longer present. Now, this issue is largely not as significant for statewide voting changes, like a statewide law, a statewide redistricting, because those get a lot of attention and are fairly, certainly these days, in the age of the Internet, are fairly well known about all over. But changes at the county level, at the school board level, water district, city council, those are changes that are happening all the time, and no one really has a way of knowing about them, either in the community or certainly in the advocacy world, without Section 5. It's an enormous gap. It's as if the lights have just been turned off, and we can't see voting changes anymore. So in looking at sort of what a legislative response could look like, I think that we have been trying to think that there are three really big mandates. Whatever we try to do has to be something that is politically possible. We live in a very a very challenging political environment, though frankly the political environment in Washington has been challenging certainly for the 17 years I've been here. And some say it's more challenging now. All challenges also present opportunities. But it has to be politically possible. It also has to be legislation that is constitutional. Now, in the wake of Shelby County versus Holder, what that really means is frankly unclear, because there wasn't a lot of constitutional analysis in the decision. There wasn't a lot of talk of the Bernie line of cases about congruence and proportionality or about the 15th Amendment's mandate on Congress. So it's somewhat unclear what the majority of this Supreme Court would think is constitutional. They haven't really given us much of a roadmap. But we're going to have to try and divine what that is so that whatever the legislation is sort of cued to some understanding of what might be constitutional. And the third part, of course, is that it has to actually protect voters from discrimination. So it has to work in some way, though I think everyone agrees that nothing will be as effective as the old Section 5. So, as I said before, part of what we're looking at is to try to identify some kind of new preclearance formula, trying to figure out, is there a way to identify those jurisdictions based on data? Because if it's a formula, it has to be data-driven, that have, based on data, we can identify which jurisdictions really need to have the preclearance remedy, where nothing else, we think, based on the record of that place, is going to work to continue this progress that we've made over the past 45 years to try and create equality in our electoral system. So who needs preclearance? We're also looking at ways to expand the role of federal courts, to expand their ability to bail jurisdictions in to, or to bring jurisdictions into the Section 5 preclearance regime. Right now, as I noted, their ability to do that is fairly circumscribed. So are there ways to broaden that ability to bring new jurisdictions in? Also, we're looking at, is there some kind of mechanism where we could have a way to more easily stop potentially discriminatory voting changes anywhere in the country from being implemented? Is there some sort of procedure that we can put in place that would create that where you can make a threshold showing around discrimination will allow you to sort of freeze voting changes in place for a determination to be made about whether or not that change is discriminatory. And finally, we are looking to explore ways that we could reinstate some kind of public notice and some level of disclosure around certain types of voting changes, particularly where, I mean, I think notice for the whole range of voting changes would be very helpful, but certainly that's going to be true at the level below the statewide level, and also for the kinds of changes that have most often in the past been linked to discrimination. So to be able to kind of have some way to have disclosures around those types of changes that would give the community, and including the advocacy community, an opportunity to really engage on the question about whether or not these changes are discriminatory. So maybe I'll just stop there and then be happy to answer people's questions.
If you would like to ask a question, please signal by pressing star 1 on your telephone keypad. If you're using a speakerphone, please make sure your mute function is turned off to allow your signal to reach our equipment. Again, press star 1 to ask a question. And we'll pause for just a moment to allow everyone an opportunity to signal for questions. Once again, that is star 1 to ask a question. And we'll take our first question from Morris Baller with Goldstein.
Hi, I wonder if you could expand a little bit on your discussion of Section 3C from the standpoint of how litigators and advocates might, in some circumstances, be able to use this mechanism to reinstate a preclearance requirement for particular bad jurisdictions, bad wrongdoing jurisdictions.
Well, the way it works now is that if you are in court in a lawsuit in which you're alleging a violation of the 14th or 15th Amendment related to voting, and you get a finding from the court, you can have as one of your claims, one of your claims for relief to be that that jurisdiction be subject to 3C. And then if the court finds that there has been intentional discrimination in violation of the Constitution, it has the discretion to order the 3C remedy. So right now in Texas, there is, Texas had their redistricting litigation that went on. They resolved it. The plaintiffs prevailed in showing that the old plan was both retrogressive, and there were some findings in the D.C. court. It's kind of complicated. In the D.C. Section 5 proceeding, there were some findings of intentional discrimination by the Texas legislature. So now in the Texas case itself, which hasn't had final judgment, they added a claim for a 3C remedy. So they're now litigating the question as to whether or not part of the remedy in that case should be that the state of Texas is subject to Section 5 preclearance. So you could do
is
that.
Is the remedy discretionary with the court?
It is.
Even after a finding of intentional discrimination in violation of the Constitution?
Yes, it is. As it's written now, yes, it is. Because remember, this statute was developed in a world where there was preclearance, right? So there was sort of much of the country, 25% of the country was covered by a Section 5 preclearance obligation, so you didn't need 3C. It was really for places it was kind of a safety valve for courts to be able to say, hey, well, you know what, you missed a place. So it wasn't meant to be the main engine for determining what places are subject to preclearance. So I think it's a question when we look at sort of legislative responses, the extent to which there are certain circumstances that where you might want to kind of define the discretion for the court a little bit around circumstances that would that seem to suggest that preclearance is an appropriate remedy.
Other than the Texas statewide apportionments, which are famously intentionally discriminatory and held in many court decisions over the last few decades, mm-hmm. Are there other circumstances you could give us by way of examples of where you think that remedy might be at least potentially attainable? What would we be looking for in terms of fact patterns that might bring this remedy within reach?
I think really anywhere where you have a finding of intentional discrimination is a place, particularly where you have, in Texas, sort of a pattern of conduct. I think that courts are likely to be more open to ordering a 3C remedy where there is both the statutory threshold is met around intentional discrimination, but also that it's sort of part of a pattern or a big problem in that place. But again, I think this is an area where it may be that that we need to give courts both more discretion and more guidance if they are going to be part of the main engine of having preclearance apply to jurisdictions. And that's something that we're talking about.
And we'll go to our next question from Zachary Paris with Jones Day.
Yes, thank you. Didn't Justice Ginsburg take the majority to task about its assertion that there was no record, essentially, of current violations, that the record was based strictly on 40-year-old activities? And specifically, the Judiciary Committee, I understand, had significant hearings or a significant number of witnesses to current events.
Yeah.
And it seems so blatant that they had their mind made up and they completely disregarded the legislative record.
Correct. That's my view, too, which is why it's really hard to figure out what's constitutional for this court. I mean, Justice Roberts relied most significantly in his decision on this doctrine of equal sovereignty of the states. He didn't tackle the record. He didn't talk about the record. He didn't talk about congruence and proportionality. He didn't talk about anything except for a lot of talk about the equal sovereignty of the states, which, as you probably know, is a doctrine that was developed pre-Civil War about who should be admitted to the Union, which states, and what the standards are. So That's the doctrine that Justice Roberts used to invalidate Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act, Section 4B of the Voting Rights Act. It is. I don't know what the word is for it, but it's what we have to deal with.
Thank you.
Okay, this is Jesse. We have a question that we received via email from Ruth Greenwood. And the question, I'll just read it verbatim. throughout your presentation, you use the term "we" in relation to the changes that are being sought, that you're seeking. Who is we? Does it involve nonprofit groups only, members of Congress, senators, others?
Yeah, so I'm working with a broad coalition of civil rights and nonprofit groups that are thinking about different ways, making proposals around possible amendments to the VRA. And certainly there are members of Congress that are engaged in this conversation as well, some with each other and then some with some of us. So it's a conversation mostly around civil rights groups and then some members of Congress. There's lots of members have been talking about in various combinations different ways to approach this. But Mr. Sensenbrenner, Jim Sensenbrenner, Republican of Wisconsin, has been very vocal about his interest and desire to enact a new voting rights bill, as has John Conyers, the ranking member on the House Judiciary Committee, and Bobby Scott, who is also on Judiciary from Virginia. So there are a number of leaders who have been vocal about this. Majority Leader Cantor has also spoken out about his interest in sort of looking at this question as to whether or not we need to do something about the Voting Rights Act. So we have a very interesting bipartisan mixture of people who are open to the conversation on the Hill and a pretty broad coalition in the groups.
Take our next question from Craig Jackson with Thurgood Marshall School of Law.
Good morning. If I understand correctly, Section 3 requires a showing of bad acts, in other words, of discrimination. With the majority saying that there is no record of present-day discrimination, is such an argument, if it ever goes to the Supreme Court, through Section 3, is that doomed before the conservatives on the majority?
Well, the court doesn't say that there's no record of discrimination. In fact, the court does acknowledge that voting discrimination continues to exist. What they say then, Chief Justice Roberts said in his opinion, is that the coverage formula that was reauthorized in 2006 was not sufficiently linked to the current needs around discrimination. So I think that, and Section 3 is right now current law. The only question is there a way to give courts more authority to recognize the need for a preclearance remedy outside of this narrow world of a finding of intentional discrimination in an existing lawsuit. So that's the needle we're trying to thread.
Present day sufficiently linked. I really had a hard time understanding what Roberts was talking about. But
it's confusing because on the one hand, he's saying that we all know that Section 5 is a remedy that is supposed to be addressing sort of systemic, repetitive patterns that is supposed to be, its constitutionality always rested on its being informed by this deep history of discrimination that is then continuing to this day. And then Chief Justice Roberts sort of says, well, but the only remedy you can really have to identify, the only way you can identify who to subject this to is to only look at what's really current. But that's kind of then detached from the past. So it's kind of like a little bit of a trick bag that we're trying to puzzle through in thinking about what, you know, how we can protect minority voters in a way that Chief Justice Roberts is going to say is okay.
Right.
Or maybe Justice Kennedy, for that matter, because he voted with Chief Justice Roberts in this last time.
Yeah. Thank you.
Once again, if you would like to ask a question, that is star 1 on your telephone keypad. Star 1 to ask a question.
This is Jesse. I'll jump in here with a question that we received over email in advance of the call. You mentioned a number of features that you would like to see the legislation have, and I think generally it sounded like it was legislation that would have been modeled on the previous Section 4 to some degree. You know, there are
some people in the aftermath of Shelby County and even beforehand have advocated for, you know, for a different kind of approach, maybe an approach that might follow along the lines of things like of legislation like the National Voter Registration Act or the Help America Vote Act, that kind of that instituted broad voting protections, not necessarily following the racial discrimination model of the Voting Rights Act. Others have said, you know, why don't we go to universal preclearance? I was wondering if you could comment on some of those alternative approaches as opposed to the Section 5 model that that we had once and that potentially could be pursued again.
Sure. So I'm all for broad voting protections, and you know, the NVRA has really been a transformative statute for our work to try and create a real democracy of the people, and getting people to participate in the electoral process. But I have to say the problems that are being addressed or that have been addressed by the Voting Rights Act and by, particularly by Section 5, have been problems of racial discrimination. And I think the way that is generally you're best able to solve problems of racial discrimination is by sort of saying this is the, you know, identifying the problem and then having a mechanism to try to solve it. And I think that that if you kind of, while it's great to try to think of ways, and I support very many of them, to kind of generally expand the electorate, if you still have racial discrimination, you're still not meeting your goal. You could expand the electorate generally, but then still allow policies and procedures, particularly again at the local level, that are disproportionately blocking out certain parts of the population, and we haven't kind of met our goals. And then certainly legislation that you do that's sort of on that model of the NVRA and HAVA is legislation that you pass pursuant to your election clause authority, which is then limited to federal elections or where there's a federal candidate on the ballot. So if you get outside the sort of 14th and 15th Amendment, then you're more limited in the types of reforms you can even pursue. On universal preclearance, I think the whole reason that preclearance is constitutional at all is because it is fairly narrow in the sense that you are infringing upon the sovereignty of states to require them to get federal approval before they can implement voting changes. And so I think that there is a threshold you have to establish as to why you're allowed to do that. And I just don't think it is constitutional to do that everywhere. Now, that's not to say there couldn't be other ways to look at this. There are some folks who are talking about, could you require preclearance for certain types of voting changes where certain demographic conditions are met, if you can link that type of change to a correlation with discrimination, and that could apply universally. Certainly Section 2 applies universally. The 3C would apply applies universally as would any expansion of it. But if you're talking about preclearance itself, requiring, you know, a sovereign state to get federal okay before it can implement its law where there's no indicia of discrimination, where there's no, that I think would not be constitutional.
Before we close, I have just one more question here, and people should still feel free to punch in their questions. But are there in the aftermath of Section 5, are there new approaches in litigation that are being pursued either by groups or the Department of Justice, and are there particular cases that people who are watching these issues should have an eye on as they move forward to see the evolution of the law post Shelby County?
Well, I think a lot of people are looking at ways that they can try to utilize existing 3C authority that courts have to include claims of intentional discrimination in their cases, even where before they wouldn't have necessarily included the claim because they didn't need it to win, but to try and include that claim so they can get that finding, which could then give courts their authority to bail the jurisdiction in. I think people are also looking at, there's a lot of litigators who are having conversations about how they can build networks in state that can help them identify voting changes so that they can intervene even pre-litigation, but sort of to get the community to know what's happening so they could do local or state-based advocacy to try and stop these voting changes from even being put into place and then and if that fails, then to have a network where they can be coordinating effectively around litigation. The one case that I'll highlight for folks on the call that I think is worth looking at about what this post-Shelby world looks like is a case out of Pasadena, Texas. Pasadena, Texas is the second largest city in Harris County, about 150,000 people. They had a city council that was 8 single-member districts. There was a proposal to change that to 6 single-member districts and 2 districts elected at large. The mayor of the town has said that the reason that he put that on the referendum ballot just 2 weeks ago was because there was no more Section 5 preclearance or obligations. I think it seems like there's a pretty good argument that the reason why the folks put this on the ballot was to stop the influence of the growing Latino population, which has increased like 50% in the past 10 or 15 years. And that's the kind of change that would have been subject to preclearance pre-June 25th. But now it's not, and it's the new law. And there are going to be folks looking to see if they can challenge that under Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act and if they can win it. And so I think it's good to keep an eye on sort of places like Pasadena, Texas, where you see changes in methods of election and folks trying to use existing tools to combat them. But having said that, even if the plaintiffs prevail in Pasadena, Texas, they won't get a remedy until 2 years from now. And meanwhile, if they have an arguably discriminatory method of election in place, electing people to run the city. So that's what you get when you have after-the-fact remedies. And you don't have a way to stop these changes from being implemented where there is some indication that there's racial discrimination.
Well, thank you.
It appears there are no further questions at this time. Jesse Grauman, I'd like to turn the conference back to you for any additional or closing remarks.
Thank you again for joining us today, and thank you to our guest, Julie Fernandez. Again, if you have questions about CLE, please email Katie O'Connor at KOCONNOR at acslaw.org. If you have feedback or comments on today's call, please feel free to email me at JGRAUMAN at acslaw.org. If you have friends who might be interested in this topic but weren't able to make the call, there will be a recording placed online within the next few days on our website, www.acslaw.org. You can download it. It will also be available via our podcast feed, ACS Law Talk, which you can access on iTunes. So thank you again to Julie, and thank you all for joining today's call.
Thanks, Jesse.
That does conclude today's conference. We thank you for your participation.